So, Narayan and Matthew and I were speaking this evening about together. We're speaking about the real emphasis of this practice is to live free of conditions, and yet at the same time we come to special conditions called a retreat, and we learn that a certain perception of life is available to us within those conditions that seem not to be available with more hectic and circumstantial and daily activity. And so it's normal, and most of us in the early phase of our training lean on the retreat environment to sort of show us what's relevant and to put perspective in our life, to show us a kind of relativity of what it would be like if we could live like this all the time. And yet we can't. Many of us have obligations that prohibit prolonged retreating. And perhaps some of us just don't want that to be our lifestyle, which is certainly understandable. But where we make a mistake is that when we leave here, we start leaning back to what we had here. The effects, the subtlety of the states of mind, the focus that we may have had, even the consuming mindful continuity that we've tried to establish in the hectic day-to-day movement, all that seems to get dispelled somehow. And we think that our spiritual lives have been upended because of the change of these conditions, and so we sort of plot our next retreat, and et cetera, et cetera. Well, for a while, that's the way some, or perhaps most of us, work our spiritual lives versus our daily life. But for some of us, there's a richer and deeper intention that is carried over from retreat, because the real sustaining power of retreat is not so much the subtlety of the mental states it gives us, or the beautification of life that is available to us within the quiet of this setting, but the establishment of intention, because that translates. And everything else that doesn't translate. It's circumstantial. It's because of special conditions that those things were available at one point and are not available now. And the point of Buddhism is to be free of conditions. So it must mean that awakening is possible equally within both environments. It doesn't require just that detailed and undistracted life for awakening, for the awakened potential to be at hand. And it's much more of the commitment and the intention that is the establishing fact as to whether the daily life activities actually can access us sufficiently so that awakening is possible. And if we think in terms of opposition, this as opposed to retreat, if I really had it together, I'd spend more of my time on retreat. That leaning away from daily activity and towards the specialty of a retreat environment undermines the potential of awakening in your daily life. Because you aren't interested in it in the same way as your retreat life. Retreat life is where I can really get it together, right? Okay, so wrong. Not right, wrong. We have to shake off that. It's a lot. It's a lot because it's very special here. It's very lovely. You have, in the course of just a few days, have gone through much of the intolerance and argument that you came in with, much of the conflict and resistance that you entered the retreat were settled down within those first couple of days. But boy, did you scream. It was, you know, rather turbulent in here. And till you realized the benefit of quiet and conceded your life to quiet, and then this stuff started healing, and then you reached a point in midway in the retreat up until through till now, well, where it just seems like this is just, there's a beauty here, there's a simplicity here, a loveliness here. And some of you may say, oh, I just wish I could continue. You know, it's so wonderful. And it's because you were taking your life and transposing a different set of criteria upon it as to what was important. No longer was the argument, the resistance, the righteousness, the upheaval, the all of that, that wasn't what was important. What was important was the quietude, the simplicity, groundedness. And that grounded us right into quiet. And so the retreat worked as it works, but now you will go back into daily life and things will be kicked up again. And you may lose the reference point of what you did to become quiet. Don't lose the reference point. Don't lose the way you transformed yourself when you first got here to now. Don't lose the context of what occurred, the sense of self-allowance and self-appreciation, the emphasis on relaxation and letting be, this willingness not to constantly seek distractions and entertainment. Those are very transferable intentions across the field of your life. But what happens is that the culture doesn't emphasize that. It emphasizes pleasure seeking and entertainment and loud noise. And it keeps you from realizing that we've assumed a bum rap, that this is a false nirvana, you might say. And it keeps us not asking deep and very important questions, not only about ourselves, but about circumstances, etc. And we want to ask those better questions. And to do that, you have to have a certain sincerity of heart that can move effortlessly in and out of different circumstances so that those questions don't get lost within circumstances. And I encourage you to reemphasize daily, several times, your intention for your life. What do you want your life to be about? Because that intention will correct the distortions that culture, the built-in distortions that culture brings. And it will keep you on track to ask the right questions for yourself. And asking those poignant and important questions is the way through the daily activities, because nothing touches a question. If you hold a question, you compel yourself towards the answer. In some kind of energetic way, you can't rest until that answer is absolutely known to you. And so a questioning is one of the most important aspects of spiritual life in a lay setting. And as you begin to ask these questions, they're sometimes troubling and sometimes are at odds with the very culture you're within. And that's fine. Keep asking the questions anyway. And find your own orientation to the culture through those questions. Okay. Anyone have any questions? Yes.
Earlier today, Narayan suggested a question. What is the quality of my heart right now? question about the quality of the mind. At least on my level of practice, the mind reveals itself. Thoughts, when you look at that and see the content. How does the heart reveal itself? Through intentions, through emotions? And how do we develop the practice?
So I can't answer for Narayan. Okay, I can just answer. Yes, I will. But I just want to say to begin with that, you know, Narayan said this, so I didn't say it, so I don't claim to have her answer for this. But the question was to monitor the quality of your heart. Monitor the quality of your heart. And his question is, what about the mind? You know, how about the quality of the mind? And the way I would answer that question is that by the quality of your heart, what I would mean is that sense of availability to life, that sense of the willingness to connect. And how I would work with that is that when the mind was disturbing that essential element of connection, of intimacy, that is the route towards greater caring and greater compassion and greater love. To see what was interfering with the need or the urgency to connect with life, to see what was disturbing that. And it's often a self-regard, it's often a mental activity. It can be an emotion that seems very personally troubling. It can be a story that is kicking up a lot of dust. But to remember, you know, that life is closer, is more proximate than it seems. It's more intimate than we know it to be through our perceptual field. And so we have to keep moving ourselves closer, even though it's betraying the distance that perception seems to indicate. So which one are we going to listen to? We're going to listen to the mind's distance or the heart's intimacy. And so when we decide that we want to move towards the heart's intimacy, there are ways, very skillful ways to do that. But they're not self-protective ways. Self-protection or self-defense actually distances ourselves and isolates us, right? So we want to be able to move this thing in accordance to the greater communion available that our heart seems to indicate. And so one of those things is, and I carry some of these sayings with me because they are very helpful, but one was seek to understand before you try to be understood. So seek first to understand the situation you're in, which means you're receiving it, before you try to manipulate the situation to your advantage. Okay, so you take it in. And then once you take it in, what you'll find is that what you want to do with it is very different than the knee-jerk response before you understood what the situation really was. Right? So that's moving with the heart. And then sometimes we just want to control it and everybody shut up and let me have my way. Okay, that's the mental urge to remain in control, to stay and to make it arranged in accordance to my desires and wishes. But that's, the heart's not beating in that perception. It's very distant. And so if we're interested in moving in accordance to the heart, we need to take in the situation to see what it calls for before we act, right? So that's one way that we can really monitor our own inward resources to see what is called for in any situation. The other, and I think this is something that's often missed, is the activity that is always available to us, but we don't fine-tune it, and that's listening. Listening is a receptive quality of mind. To do real listening, we, the opinionated mind, the ones that has all the, you know, the facts. And so how we usually listen is that we meet what we hear with the facts we know. And then we compare that meeting with our facts, and then we let in what's compatible with that, and we keep out what's incompatible with our facts. So that's not really listening, that's just self-agreement, really, right? So instead of doing it that way, if you just listen through the natural mental obstructions that are there, the different ways that we self-protect, the different opinions we have about people and about things and about situations, and just put those in abeyance so that you're actually listening. The fear we have is that if we do let this in, this listening will change us. It'll change us in ways that may not be agreeable to the facts that I now have. Well, we rest assured it will change us. And quite likely it won't be in conjunction or in alignment with the facts we now hold. And that's real change. But it won't be contradictory to our integrity or to our wisdom or to our intimacy or to the need to connect and commune. It will be an adjustment in alignment with truth rather than in alignment with the facts that we have known the truth to be. And that's very important to keep asking ourselves, because then growth is continuous. We never have the answer, the final answer. Any answer we place on it is just another set of conditions through which reality has to permeate. What is this? You know? And then, therefore, there's a lifelong, and it's really actually beautiful, because there's a lifelong alteration that's occurring. Growth is never finished, right? There's something truly inspiring to me about the fact that we're never done, right? I mean, if you're done, what does that mean? That you're become some kind of brick? It just doesn't make any sense. Doneness doesn't make any sense to me. Done for me, it's if we have the ability to move and to shift and to let life move us and change us, and then that you could say was the wise alignment to life. But that means that you're never done, because there's always new movement. So, yes.
If one should stumble across one of the foundations of what's causing conditioning in your life, very deep foundation, is there any way to work with it, or you just sit and let it unfold?
If one comes across a foundation of what sort of sets your, I suppose you're talking about a psychological foundation, a conditioning, an assumption that you've lived with. Is that sort of, okay, yeah. And what do you do with it? Well, that's a very important question. And it's one that I think for a long period of time, I think this tradition has simplified, oversimplified. And the reason I say that, I'm not pointing any fingers, it's just that the tradition has deepened as we, as teachers and students, have deepened. Because initially the instructions were just to be with it and to be accepting of it and to be allowing, which is a beautiful first step, because you're acknowledging the fact it's there and you're not fighting with it quite as much, right? But it's that response for most hardened assumptions about ourselves, like self-hatred, which is a permeation of insufficiency or inadequacy or unworthiness or all of that, that doesn't get to the core assumption. It just learns to deal with it politely. It's like you have a gangster in the room who you're trying to have teach good manners. I don't know where that came from. So we've got to go to a deeper level of okay. So the first thing I often have people do is to find a root issue that is the assumption. So instead of self-hatred, you can eventually find your way to some, you know, I'm inadequate. That's the root issue that leads to self-hatred. Okay, so once you land on that, and just to share mine, it was something's wrong with me. Okay, so something's wrong with me. You know, something's wrong with me. No wonder you think what you do about me, because there's something wrong with me. No wonder I can't do it, because there's something wrong with me. You see? But it's very helpful to get it into a sentence or a phrase, because then you can use that phrase to expose the pain that's hidden behind it. Now, why would I want to do that? That sounds pretty awful, doesn't it? But you do it because the exposure of the pain is what heals it. And just bringing your attention to it lightly and gently doesn't bring up the issues and the belief that I'm a mistake. And in order to uproot the sense that I am a mistake, I have to go into the hottest fire, which is where I believe I am a mistake. It doesn't get any hotter psychologically than that. It's the trauma that we all carry. And when you're exposed to it, there's no greater shame than somebody seeing that. And so we do everything we can to protect other people from seeing that assumption and for us to see that assumption as well. So what I do, first of all, or suggest, I never force people into this unless they want to go. I say, okay, be a cultural anthropologist to yourself. That means we're not going to disturb the culture of your self-hatred. We're just going to get the facts. So I'm going to start taking notes, the language I use on myself when I feel like I'm a mistake, how I see the world when I feel that, the compensating activities that I go through when I feel like I'm a mistake, the narrative that is revealed with it, just the landscape of all this. It gets very interesting because it becomes, as a root issue, it becomes one of the central ways and motivations for our behavior. And when you begin to see how widespread it is, it just sends you reeling to see how controlled we are by this assumption that has never been exposed to light. Not, and here's an important adjunct, is that when we were small and didn't have any way to counter the argument, people told us or showed us or indicated us, so somehow we assumed we were a mistake. And we never challenged that. And it was conditioned into us at a particular age, and for most of us, we can see the circumstances of our childhood in which that, whatever your root issue is, was engendered. Okay? So we each have it. And it's often, in this culture, has something to do with inadequacy. Okay, so now here's the important point. If there was a time, sometime between birth and early childhood when I didn't have it, and then there was a time when I did have it, that means it was conditioned into me. It's not genetic. I didn't get born thinking what a mistake I was, right? And because of that, it can be extinguished. And that's important to know, because when we believe it to be true about us, we don't think it's extinguishable. We really don't. We think that that's just the fact of who we are. We really think that's it. We've come to the bottom line. Okay, you can talk all you want to about selflessness, but I'm inadequate. Period. That's my trump card. That's old maid. You can play all your ace of hearts. Trumped it. No pun intended. Okay, so... Okay. So that's how hot the fire is. Okay, so it takes dedication. But I assure every one of you two things. One is that you are not that assumption. That there's beauty that lies far vaster than some narrative that you've learned to express about yourself. And you can uproot it if you wish. And if you get serious, you can do it in a relatively quick period of time. Months, not years. But you have to get very, very serious about it. And it's possible. And sometimes, I mean, believe me, I'm not some kind of warrior. But when I saw that and how it was controlling me from a deeper abiding within emptiness, I took it on as the most important thing I could possibly do. And I would walk back and forth and I would say to myself, there's something wrong with me. And I would say it not to reinforce the fact, but to expose the fact. So this gushing forth of how awful I really am would come up, and I would just pace it back and forth. And I would let whatever was coming out of that pattern speak. I hate myself. No wonder I'm I've done this and I've done that. And I just, but nothing. I would add nothing contemporary to the language. I wouldn't say, there I go again, I'm always doing that. I would let it come from the past. A stream of consciousness that was locked into the cells of my body that I was just allowing to be unleashed. And then I would stay with it until it would keep going and going, and then it had nothing else to say, and I would stay with it to make sure it had nothing else to say, and then it would be quiet, and I would too. And how's that? And it didn't take too many repetitions of that before that was uprooted. But it was the hardest thing, because I can't express the difficulty. It is where we believe ourselves. It is what we believe. And that's why it's like, ugh. That's the deepest secret that we keep hidden. Yes.
Earlier today, doing mental practice, and Narayan brought up doing that to the difficult person, bringing them into the room. The only way it felt possible for me to do it was to imagine that the person was really far in the distance.
Was what?
Uh-huh.
For safety. Yeah. She's talking about in metta, the difficult person, the only way she could really bring in the most difficult people is to keep them at a distance. And she's wondering if that's a legitimate way to do it, or if she's bypassing something. I think perhaps you chose somebody that was a little too difficult. I'm not being sarcastic, I really mean that. I would, when the difficult, just people that you have a little bit of issue with, not somebody that you feel unsafe with. Because that brings forth too much of an impact. What we're trying to do here, so here's metta practice. What we want to do is to move below the opinions and judgments we have to people, to their humanity, so that we can see the commonality of humanity. And so we've picked different categories of that are, you know, more volatile, increasingly more volatile, for us to look and to find or to search for the common element that we have with them so that we can feel safe within the common human experience. And that opens our heart in a way that judgment never can. Okay, so if you pick someone who has abused you, or that's just too much to ask without a lot of support, therapy, etc. So just pick someone who, you know, is difficult, who stepped on your toes or cut you off in traffic or somebody like that. And then, you know, just let yourself, outside of that behavior, I mean, we all do that. I mean, it's hard when you really look at what you're offended by not to claim reference to that offense. I've done that. Yeah, okay, I did that. But he did it. No, I've done it too. You know, so just start owning the activity that you are righteous about. And also, you know, we have bad days, we have good, I mean, just the whole mix of problems and how problems obstruct our connection. And I mean, all of that, there are some people who set out in the day to be vicious and unkind. There are those types of people, but not, the majority of people don't. Majority of people commit their altercations because they're in pain, like we are. And if we can connect with that common element of reacting from pain, we can then have a different relationship to that person's activity than we could with just a righteous indignation. Okay, so that's what it means to do. So there are levels to metta. Metta is not metta practice. Metta means love, loving kindness. Loving kindness, metta practice is to sort of show us why it is that we stay so distant to love. One, through our judgments, through our opinions of other people and that. That's one expression of how we keep ourselves contained and separate from the rest of humanity. But there are different levels of connectedness. There's the level of connectedness on our humanity, but that's just one level. There's also a level of connectedness that we all share in our abiding within awareness. It's universal. Everything is held within awareness. And as we begin to commune from that space, then you begin to see very, very different level of interconnectedness than you do just through the common humanity of us all. You really touch the fiber and fabric of what love is. And as we touch that for the first time, you will know what it means to be loved, because it holds you as well as all things. And for the first time, there's no judgment that's connected with that perception of love. You know how we try as hard as we can, you know, to accept things, but there's always some a little bit of friction in that, if we're honest. It's never complete relinquishment of that resistance, but it's, we talk ourselves into a pretty good story of it, of harmony. That's okay. But it's not until we have dropped the narrative of our life entirely that the story ends. And at that point, there's a different communion available, and a deeper knowledge of what love is, and a willingness to drop our guard in order to access that more frequently. Yes?
Well, sometimes
So the question is, there's some concern that if he gets too close to the object, so there's no distance between you and that object, that you'll lose the awareness or the mindfulness associated with the practice and that you won't be practicing at all. I would test that theory. I would really test it. The only thing, you see, what the distance is only conceptual. So you have to continue to think difference, distance. It's not there intrinsically. And thinking distance is not the way to mindfulness or awareness. It's the release of narrative, the release of thought that shows you the field of awareness, that where the field of awareness is revealed. But as you decrease the narrative, as you get quieter, it doesn't mean that you're suddenly welded to the person in proximity. That is, that you don't, you know, suddenly this thing doesn't become a blob. You see differently. You don't see distance. Distance is not a separating factor. Right? In fact, space is not a separating factor. Space is part of oneness. And so nothing interferes with that uniformity. And so if you don't be concerned that giving up thought is going to interfere with awareness, the less thought, the more awareness. Okay, so try it and see. Let's try and see. Your question is still the same. To come as close as you can to it means that you drop your description of it. You drop the words that keep you distant from it. That's why it feels as if we're distant from our breath, because we keep inserting a story about how we're doing in relationship to breath and how our breath is doing, et cetera, et cetera. That goes on top of the breath as we bring our attention to it. Awareness, you won't lose yourself. You won't become like, you know, people say, you know, I stood by the tree and I became the tree. I don't know what that means. You don't stand out there thinking a squirrel's going to. I don't know what that means. All I know what that means to me is that I'm not expressing a conversation with the tree. And so the field of tree becomes inclusive with the sense of me. Okay? So test those theories. Yeah. When I did my uprooting of a deep issue, was that in a retreat environment? No. Is that home? But it can be anywhere. Right. So again, you see, when you have one intention for life, which is why I teach with Narayan, because we both share the same intention, it doesn't matter where you are. You don't wait it out. I've got a retreat in 6 weeks. I'll put it off. You don't do that. You don't do that. You know, and it, because there's nothing in your way ever. Nothing's ever in your way. And when you really understand that there's nothing ever in your way, you're very close to the truth. I'm actually, it's kind of amazing, because I can be at home, people can come in and out, have interviews. And they're talking all about how to work their lives so that, you know, they can have a, you know, a mindful experience of it, or whatever they're talking about. And there it is. I mean, it's like, you don't want, I'm not criticizing this. But it's like it's right there. You know, it's not far away. And the more we talk about how we're going to do it, the more distance we create from it. And I really understand that I can't encourage people across that distance before they're ready. So we sit there and talk about how to do it, you know, at home and how to get closer to it, and that's okay. But everyone should realize that it's immediately accessible. And therefore, circumstances never matter. Why do you think that Narayan and I have decided to teach in the city and do occasional retreats rather than teach retreats and occasionally go to the city? Because that's where the balance needs to occur. We're such a retreat-oriented tradition that the balance needs to come back into our life, not on retreat. Most people want to teach retreats because that's where their understanding lies. I like occasional retreats, but that's not where I want to take up my position, Dharma position. So it's available if you'd like it. Yes, Roy, in the back there. Root issue. Right. I really understand that, Roy. No. Right. No, I totally understand. Thank you. So, talking about the root issue and how confusing it is and how extraordinarily painful it is, and the grief that emanates from it, and the confusion that we get lost within that, and the memories and the stories that just seem to permeate all of that. Now, it can be helpful, depending upon the severity of our childhood experiences, to have someone sit across from us, called a therapist, who can hold the space evenly and with balance so that you can talk about these issues and see in their eyes that they are still accepting of you, even though you're not of yourself. That's very helpful to regain your own balance when you have somebody who can listen to your story and not foster the same reaction of self-hatred toward you that you are of yourself. But if you're going to pay somebody, you make sure they're good. Don't just pay them for friendship. And yes, you have to trust them. And if that's an issue, okay, so no, I hear that that may be part of the whole issue. So start trusting. So you have to start somewhere. Okay, so start now. and look around and just say, what is there in my proximity that I can't trust? There's a lot of feelings of mistrust, but that's from my past. That betrays the fact that this is actually a safe environment, and I'm going to go with a fact rather than the way my mind is coloring the present situation. It's a projection of mistrust. It's not a fact of mistrust. So I can get a sense of that, certainly in this environment, that this is really a safe environment, although I may be projecting mistrust onto this safety. Now I can move a little bit, and I'm going to act as if it is trusting, even if I don't feel that sense of trust. And as you begin to act from trust, which means your body acts from trust, it means you stand up differently, it means you look at the situation very differently, it means you receive it very differently, and that you don't listen to the fear element associated with them, then you'll find that the body starts correcting that very slowly over time, and the circumference of your trust grows. So then you actually want to do it with a person. So you get with somebody who seems to be somebody who cares about you, or someone who has integrity. Sometimes it can be a spouse. Sometimes it can be a friend or somebody who has the integrity, and you sense integrity. You should be able to sense integrity. And then you say, okay, then you just develop a friendship with that person. And you let that friendship be more trusting. You start exposing little pieces of yourself and you see what comes back. If nothing comes back, then wow, maybe this person is. You just do it that way, right? Don't stay within mistrust and proclaim it to be true. Because you will die that way. We die the way we live. And you don't want to die mistrusting. So it's self-corrected. It's another expression of the pattern of the root issue. You know, and your root issue doesn't sound that much different from mine. You just haven't found the phrase, I'm no good, or something. But you will if you want to, and it'll fit, and it'll fit like a glove. You'll go, oh my God, I'm no good. I know I'm no good. Wow. Boy, did anyone hear me? I hope not. Oh my God, I'm no good. It's like that. Okay? Tenderness. This is when the Dharma, it's nice to have a Buddha around sitting on your lap. Buddha dear, I'm no good. You're no good either. you make it a little light. Make it a little light. You can do this. This is one thing. So you get this issue, something wrong with me, and then, okay, I'm going to play this out to its extreme. I get on the ground and beat, you know, I'm no good, I'm no good, I'll prove you I'm no good. Look at that mirror, see, I'm no good. You know, it's like that. You exaggerate it to such significance that you begin to smile a little bit at this thing. You lighten it up a little bit because it's so funny how it'll make us act. And then when you smile, it just brings a little bit of, okay, I can do this, you know. This is hard, but I can do this. Now, again, I'm not sure, because I'm not a therapist, how helpful therapy is and at what degree of pain it can be helpful to have a therapist. I sort of just did it because I wanted to. But I think that it could be helpful to have other people listen to those issues and help me steady my own self-acceptance. So I don't want to dismiss it all. Well, don't get too caught up in that. You already got the feeling of it. Just be with the feeling of it. I'm awful or whatever, you know, I hate myself or I'd like to, whatever you're, pardon? That's easy. Okay, well then the issue is not far from there. You know, it'll arrange itself in a sentence or two. What's that? I'm evil. That's a great one. You see, well, I don't bat an eye to that. Very simple, you're evil. Great. Join us all. Look to your left. Okay, it's just what you've learned to believe. It's what you learned to believe I'm evil. So I can believe anything. I'm a rabbit. I can believe anything. Give me enough input and I will believe that. Okay. Okay. Yes, sir.
Trying to tie together a few things that you brought up as themes this week. I'm really interested in the idea of the conceptual overlay, because that seems to describe so completely almost the entirety of my view of life. And I really became aware of that this week, that that's all that I'm seeing is my own concept.
Yeah, beautiful. Yes.
For a period of time, about 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And it eventually sort of came slowly flooding back in. But I at least have the faith that it is possible to live
the certainty
outside of that.
Yeah, that's right.
But I guess I'm looking for that magic crystal. How does one find a way to let that conceptual framework, that conceptual overlay, soften in time? You talked about
right.
This some already.
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to. Yeah, so it's about conceptual overlay and how subtle it can become, and how to get a handle of what we're doing to the world that's making it mind created. Well, you know, it's this is something that I find very interesting and something I do often. I look at my assumptions on the world, right? And there are some very, very hard and important assumptions that I'm very attached to, like life should be fair. Okay, so when it's not, it causes an irritation. That's a philosophy I have, and people better line up with that or you're going to get my disgust, right? The problem is that it's not a truth. It doesn't line up fairly, you know? You know, and so I'm when I see that it's just a philosophical overlay, I get very interested in how I hold that to be truth, and I get in my irritation is exposed because not because of reality, but because that overlay isn't being lived up to. So philosophies, our beliefs, our opinions, our assumptions, our conceptual justifications. I mean, the whole thing comes together in attitudinal belief. The whole thing cements itself within here. You know, and none of it is true. No, everything has been conjured up and placed and projected out. It's very interesting to start living and seeing, you know, that all of the different ways that we believe life should line up are just things that we've told ourselves that it should be. So start perceiving the different ways that we have scolded life into a mental disposition, and it doesn't mean a thing to life. Big fish should not eat small fish. It's not fair. So you just start get, you know, and just start seeing that, because it's a level of subtlety that mostly we miss in meditation. We mostly miss that one. But it's there. And it is amazing when you see how engrossed we are, the world has become, within our resolution, our philosophical resolution. We know exactly how it should be, should line up. Right? It just doesn't. So that's all right. Okay, I think that's it for this evening. And I want to thank you for your attention. And maybe we can just sit for a minute or two. So you don't have to turn to the left. You don't have to turn to the right. You don't have to look up or down. You don't have to hold your body in a certain alignment. You couldn't possibly lose it. It's been with you since you were spanked on your behind and before. You've never been without it. You couldn't possibly be without it, not even for an instant. It's with you prior to your daily sitting, during your daily sitting, after your daily sitting, in car wrecks, an illness, but circumstances are so capture us, we so invest in the circumstances that we miss this. Closer to you than your breath, in your breath, where are we going to look for it if it's everywhere? How are we going to seek it when it surrounds us? What journey, what pilgrimage are we going to go on to make it clearer to us that it's us, itself, us, it's us? It's there before the bow, during the bow, and after the bow. And we bow. Enjoy your practice.